Hi, welcome to Measure the Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument, maybe it's ancient, or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, what it does, who built it, when it was built, and how it was built, why it was built, all of them W words.
That's right. All right, so today we're going to talk about Stonehenge.
Now, I'm pretty excited about this one. I think Stonehenge is very cool.
And I was very reluctant to do this episode.
Yeah, Vivian was just like, oh, there's nothing to it. There's nothing to it. It's just a stupid thing. And I was just like, no, it's going to be cool. And sure enough.
Yeah, I found some cool things. So let's get started. I'm sure most people know what Stonehenge is. But in case you don't, it's a large Neolithic monument in the Salisbury Plains. So it's about an hour outside of London in England.
Yes, London, England. Not London, Ontario, or any of the other million Londons around the world.
No, this is the London.
The London.
Right outside of it. It consists of multiple rings of standing stones. Most are about 4 meters high, 2 meters wide, about 22.7 metric tons each with lintels on top. So that's kind of like a horizontal stone placed on top. And then it's surrounded by even larger, taller stones, about 45 metric tons each. So we're going to talk a lot about rocks because that's basically what these are.
Yeah, you've been rolling your eyes so hard through that entire explanation. These rocks are big.
Explaining what Stonehenge is. Everyone knows.
But what if they don't?
Yeah.
What if this is somebody's introduction to Stonehenge? It's big rocks. Just like they're big. They're really big. So we went to Stonehenge and Vivian was so annoyed. We went to London and I want to see Stonehenge. Vivian was just like, okay, well, fine. I'll go and we can go see Stonehenge, right? So then I went and everybody always is just like, oh, Stonehenge is not as big as I was expecting it to be, right? And so then I went and I was expecting Stonehenge to be tiny, but it's big. Stonehenge is really big. It's so much bigger than I was expecting. I was expecting it to be small and it's so much bigger than what I was expecting. I think that Stonehenge is very cool. It's very impressive. It's tall.
It's a lot of things. And I'm going to put this in context because I think context is what really made this stand out for me. Okay. So back to the features, we're going to talk about two main types of stones. So the sarsen stones and the blue stones. Okay.
Okay.
The sarsen stones are the bigger ones. The blue stones are the smaller ones. If you've ever been to Stonehenge, they used to have blue stones that you can touch. So they would have a blue stone kind of like near the entrance or near the tourist centers where you can touch it and you can feel that it's just slightly cooler. Like it feels a little different. And that's just because of the way that the stone absorbs heat. But if you were to touch that versus the sarsen stone, it would feel just a little bit different. It also has a bluish tone when it's wet. So it's not a blue stone, but it's called blue stone because when it's wet, it kind of has a bluish tinge.
Okay, so pretty cool.
These are all really important because it really fed into what people believed about these stones and what people believed about Stonehenge. There are a number of holes that are kind of in and around Stonehenge that form part of the rings around Stonehenge within the ditch that actually surrounds the whole site. So it might not seem very important, but it signifies that there used to be something else that would have been constructed there. Maybe it was wooden, right? And they would have decomposed and it doesn't exist there anymore. Maybe it was other types of stones that they got rid of. But generally, the Stonehenge that you see now is not the whole Stonehenge that you probably would have found at its peak.
Interesting.
There's a heel stone right outside that marks the sort of the entrance, and there's kind of like a promenade that comes out of Stonehenge. It's important because it marks the sunset and the sunrise of the solstice. So the way that the whole site is oriented with the avenue that comes out, it's aligned with the solstice.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
All right. So the context of this is it was built around 3000 BC. And I don't know if that means anything to you. It certainly didn't mean anything to me, right? So it's 5,000 years ago. What does that mean?
5,000 years ago is a really long time. So Vivian, why don't you tell us what people were doing 5,000 years ago?
Okay, so 5,000 years ago, we were in the Neolithic era. What does that mean? We're kind of at the tail end of the Stone Age, okay? So this is before the Bronze Age, before the Iron Age. We had just figured out stone tools, which is pretty amazing considering we're building stone things with stone tools. It's a lot more labor intensive. You're using rocks to cut rocks. So then your tools are always breaking. They're not standing up. It's a lot of manual labor. It's not a lot of precision, which is impressive considering the detail that they actually put into Stonehenge.
Yeah, it's pretty detailed stuff. And these are big stones. I can't imagine cutting these out and, like, you know, carving them. Like, they're not perfect, but they're pretty consistent one to the other. And just imagine, like, trying to carve. They're so big. And just trying to carve that with a tool that's made of the same thing that you're trying to carve. It's so cool.
I think when you think of sculpture, you're thinking of, like, a chisel and a hammer, right? We weren't there.
No.
We weren't there. We were taking a piece of rock that was kind of sharp and banging it against the rock that we want to carve and chipping away at it. Okay. Yeah. So we're almost like whittling rock with rock.
Old school.
Yeah.
Super old school.
We had just discovered pottery. Guys, like, we had just figured out how to bake clay. We had just discovered agriculture. So before this, we were still nomadic hunter-gatherers. And at this point, we had just started to domesticate cereal and domesticate animals. Just started, okay?
Yeah. Brand new technology, growing a crop in the same place every year.
We're not entirely sure we even had beasts of burden back then. So what does that mean? Beasts of burden are like oxen or horses, something that we would have domesticated animals to pull or do work. So we're not sure that they even had that. At that point, it's all kind of speculation. They had just domesticated animals. They didn't have ropes. So if you think about what you need to domesticate beasts of burden, you need rope. Well, they didn't have that yet. They didn't have wheels. Okay? The wheel hasn't been invented yet.
That is absolute madness. Like, I just take for granted that there was ever... I don't know if I believe that there was anything that humans did before we invented the wheel. And then I hear, oh, by the way, they didn't have the wheel yet. I was like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, who even knows if they had invented fire yet? I mean, I'm sure they did, but...
They must have known what fire was. It does get cold.
Yes.
Yes.
So yeah, there was no rope. What they had was rawhide, right? Because they had animals. So they had leather they could have made into straps, but of course that's not strong enough to pull 45 tons of rock.
No, not a chance.
They had figured out basket weaving to a certain extent, so they could weave and I guess have twine, but that's not rope.
Right, yeah. Twine is not going to be strong enough to pull these big rocks, is it?
Right. So they don't have fiber yet. They haven't domesticated enough things to have fiber, which is why they don't have rope.
Okay.
There's a lot that goes into this. So this is a people. And of course, back then they had just started agriculture, which means that the societies and the groupings that you would have had wouldn't have been that large. So if you think about actually at the same time, the pyramids were built or being built. Mm-hmm. We know that the pyramids were built in a culture and a society that supported a lot more people than the people around Stonehenge.
Okay.
So then your manpower is also limited.
Yeah.
So you've got limited tools, you've got limited technology, and you've got limited manpower. You've got limited material to an extent, because at the time, the Salisbury Plains would have been more wooded. So you would have had high quality wood, but your rocks came from very far away. The rocks that you wanted, at least.
Yeah.
So it is impressive if you take all of those into context and how you would actually be able to build something like this to the amount of precision that it requires.
Right.
But I mean, that being said, it took a very long time. So Stonehenge was built in multiple phases. It started in 3000 BC. At 3000 BC, it didn't have rocks. It was just a ditch with a little bit of like embankment. So like a little bit of a bump and the heel stone. That was it.
Right.
But imagine the fact that back then they had a ditch and the heel stone, which meant they already knew back then the solstice and the alignment that they wanted.
Okay.
So it was planned very earlier on. 200 years later, so 2800 BCE, timber posts were erected within the henge. This is still pretty typical. There are a lot of wood henges in and around the area that have been discovered.
Okay.
200 years later, the bluestones were erected to make Stonehenge. So it took really 400 years to get us to the point where we have rocks.
Right.
I don't know of too many things today that is built over 400 years.
I mean, it was a different time back then.
It was. But you also have to remember that this was an illiterate culture. So whereas the Egyptians, when they were building the pyramids, had some sort of written tradition, the people of Stonehenge lived by oral tradition. They had no written language.
Okay. So that complicates things. This is a big part of the reason why Stonehenge is still such a mystery, right? Because...
Yes. Yes. Because of all these constraints. And I read an article that was really interesting. It said that every single archaeologist and scientist that tries to come up with a theory for Stonehenge only takes into consideration one part. And so they develop their theory based on one small portion of what Stonehenge represents. And when you extrapolate it to try to fit everything that constrains it, it doesn't fit. It's like a whole bunch of blind people feeling different parts of an elephant and calling it a different animal because they're not seeing the big picture.
It's a pretty good analogy. So Stonehenge, very big, very complex, very impressive. Right, Vivian?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll give you that. So like I said, they're an illiterate culture. And so there's some theory that Stonehenge was actually a mnemonic device to pass on mathematical knowledge through oral tradition.
Interesting.
Now, I don't totally buy it, and I'll get into it later on when we get into more detail about how it was built. You put a bunch of things in a circle and you're going to be able to draw shapes from it. Yeah?
I mean, yeah, I guess. I don't understand how a circle helps you draw other shapes, but I think that you're going to explain that to me, right?
Just because you can draw things from the different rocks that are here doesn't necessarily mean that they were built for that purpose. Like, this is the part I found really frustrating about the research of Stonehenge, is that it's very theorized. It's very hypothesized. There's no way to know for sure if any hypothesis is true. Everything has been debunked and then just disproven.
Yeah. In some cases, rebunked.
Yeah. And it doesn't sound super convincing. Like, from a scientific point of view, if I were to look at this in terms of engineering, it doesn't seem super convincing to me that that is for sure how they built it. But keeping in mind that a lot of the research that I've been reading, a lot of papers I've been reading are archaeological papers. And that's a different science from mathematics. That's a different science from physics. It's not one that has certain answers.
Yeah, I mean, archaeology, right? So your whole thing is all about like observable truths and repeatable findings, right?
Right.
And archaeology is all about like educated guesses.
Yeah, I found it very speculative and I was very skeptical of a lot of the articles I've read.
Right. Well, there's a lot to be skeptical about. I mean, this Stonehenge is a big deal. And it's, let's just say, let's put this lightly, let's just say that it has captivated the imaginations of millions of people for thousands of years. Can we say that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm guessing that you're going to tell us about how people have been captivated by this.
Yeah. And so I did research for this episode. One of the great big mysteries is how Stonehenge was built. But because we don't have any written records, there's a lot of different theories as to how Stonehenge was even used. So right now, the main theories are that it was some sort of temple, that it was some sort of burial ground, that it had some sort of astronomical significance. So you were talking about the solstice already and how that it lines up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's several theories that it was just some sort of a party room, right? So whether it was a gathering point, whether it was like a music hall, or right, anything like that, right? So there are lots of different theories. Now, the music hall one is actually interesting because I feel like this is one of those theories that came about just as like one of those, you know, kind of throwing some spaghetti at the wall to see if it sticks, right? Because supposedly when you're standing in the middle of Stonehenge, and I've never been able to do this because they don't let you stand in the middle of Stonehenge anymore, which I think is really a shame. We're going to touch on that a little bit later. But when you're standing in there, there's supposedly sort of a cancellation effect because of the way that the sound waves bounce off. So you can go stand in different parts of Stonehenge and it will actually, you have like a little bit of a quiet spot where you have the frequency cancellation. It depends on the placement of the instruments, but there are certain parts of Stonehenge that have very good acoustics. And then certain other parts where if you're sort of not having so much fun, you can go and stand and it's going to be a little bit calmer. So that's pretty cool. But I mean, it could just be a coincidence. There's nothing to suggest that it was intentionally designed for its acoustic properties.
Right. Yeah. Right. So that's one of those other things where is the theory to fit the properties or I don't know.
Yeah. So now there are a lot of different proponents of the music hall theory, but I was particularly interested by this one guy. His name is Rupert Till. And I read about him in the Telegraph article. He is specifically, so he's a DJ as well as a researcher.
Oh, a DJ researcher.
And I feel like he may have been like misquoted, but anyways, he's talking about how he believes that Stonehenge was specifically used for trance events. Right. And so
like 3000 BCE, they had trance.
So that's kind of why I scoff and roll their eyes. But there would have been with the instruments that they had, right? Because really trance music today is we think of like the electronic, like the bass drum, yeah, and it's very repetitive and everything. But there would have been drone music. I don't think that they would have had bagpipes back then. But the whole point of bagpipes is that you have this drone note and everything, right, and it's persistent.
They might have horns, which would have, yeah, given that. They would have had some type of percussion. That's probably an early form of music. Yeah,
exactly.
See it.
And so then you think of like a solstice party or some sort of like a very spiritual event. It would make sense that you would want to have sort of that like droning, trancey music to help you get into the whatever you're doing. I don't understand. I don't know what druids did. I don't know anything about druids or any of that. But it makes sense to me that they would want to have some sort of repetitive music, right?
Well, it's interesting you say that because one of the first theories about Stonehenge was that it was built by druids. But Stonehenge predates druids by something like 2,000 years.
Yeah, it's a lot. Druids did not build Stonehenge.
No, druids probably used Stonehenge.
Exactly.
But yeah, they definitely did not build it. So like, I think that's a pretty common misconception.
Yeah. So that basically covers the music hall theory in sort of bridging the party room, different ones. There's the theory that it was a gathering place. Evidence actually supposedly suggests that it was mostly for the winter solstice, whereas people typically thought that it was the summer solstice, but it shows heavier use during the winter solstice,
right,
according to some research. There's a lot of stuff in this. This is a very old thing that people have been going to across different cultures and all of this. But anyways, some evidence suggests that it was primarily used for winter solstice. And one interesting thing, the University College London, I don't know if that's a good one or not, but yes. University, it's a good one. Okay. So University College London, they were doing some research and they suspect that at a time when the population of the British Isles was 10,000 people,
right,
as many as 4,000 people would travel to Stonehenge to gather the winter solstice. Very impressive. And there was evidence to show that they came all the way from the Scottish Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a ways.
It's as far as you can get.
It's as far as you can get. And this is in winter of all times to be making that trek to go, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. So there are a lot of people who believe that because of the way that the stones are aligned, that it was used as some sort of astronomy calculator.
Yes. So I have some notes about that, but why don't you go ahead?
Those are my notes. It was some sort of, because a lot of the stuff that I read was that basically people were saying, okay, yes, it aligns with the sun, but there's a good chance that that was just coincidental because we think that this is actually a monument built to honor the female genitalia or
what?
Yeah, it's a thing. That's a real theory held by quite a few people, notably Anthony Perks from the University of British Columbia.
Oh.
Anyways, in terms of the astronomy calculator, Vivian, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. There are some theories that it is an astronomical calculator or calendar of some sort. There are a lot of different stones. There are a lot of different numbers of stones, especially if you look at the holes. So there's a lot of different rings of holes that are surrounding the stones, and you can't necessarily see them because they're not even, like, they've been covered up. We only know about them because of GPS and some ground penetrating software. We can see kind of how the ground's been disturbed. So this is from some satellite imagery that we can see there used to be these rings of holes in and around where the stones are, kind of between that and the ditch. They've been labeled various names. There's the Aubrey holes or the Aubrey stones, and that's a ring of 56 stones. There's some significance in terms of 56 stones, if you think about it astronomically. At the same time, there's some significance about almost any number if you just pick a field and say, oh, is this a significant number, right? Like, this is the part that I don't buy, that I'm just thinking, okay, so 56 stones, does that necessarily mean it corresponds with 56 certain celestial bodies? Well, that's what some people think. But even if you were to chart it, it's not totally accurate.
And also, I mean, there's more than 56 celestial bodies. So if you just sort of like say, oh, well, we've got 56 of these things. Now let's just pick 56 celestial. Like if you look up at the stars and you're trying to find a certain shape in the stars, you're going to find it, aren't you?
Well, it wasn't a specific celestial body. So one theory about the Aubrey holes is that it might have been a way to track the eclipses.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember exactly what the detail was. Either it happened every 56 years or it happened at some interval of 56 or some multiple of that. But basically what they found was it's not actually that accurate. And so it seems like the Stonehenge people were kind of dabbling in early astronomy. This would have been a very early development of astronomical science for them, right? And it wouldn't totally make sense for them to do these calculations, have these observations, and put permanence to them when they weren't that accurate, like they were kind of budding astronomers. So it would be the same as like doing math in pen. You're not sure of what you're doing yet, so why would you do it in pen?
Right.
With all that effort. So there's the argument against that theory because they've built a lot of Woodhenges, right? A lot of Woodhenges in and around Stonehenge also align to the solstice. Stonehenge is not unique in that respect. There's a lot of other structures around that time that are aligned to the solstice.
Okay.
So for this thing, that's not super accurate, not super useful if you're really predicting something, an astronomical event. Like, this is not passed down centuries of knowledge. So why would you build it in rock?
Gotcha.
And considering all the things we've discussed, no wheels, no beast of burden, no tools, it would have been a huge endeavor for something that wasn't super useful.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's kind of the argument against the astronomical calendar calculator theory, which I accept. I accept that premise.
Yeah.
Like you said, there are a lot of theories as well about how it was built. I've got some scientific ones. There are obviously some less scientific theories.
Okay. Although I think that we should, let's just close the loop on, you know, how it was used.
Close the loop.
Close the loop. Ha. That is almost a pun, but not quite. So let's go a little bit back. So when we were talking about how it does sort of have this alignment, you know, to the solstice, there's some astrological connections that you could draw if you're really trying hard. One of the main running theories right now, based on things that we've found in the area surrounding it, is that Stonehenge originated as a burial ground. There's been a lot of discussion lately that it was viewed as some sort of a healing ground, specifically that people would travel to, you know, in hopes of getting some mystical healing. I don't know how faith healing is supposed to work. I don't know any of that. But a lot of the remains that they found had experienced trauma or they were deformed. So there's this theory that people would travel to Stonehenge hoping to get healed. And so then there's also been a lot of discussion on whether these stones were erected due to the significance of the site as a burial ground. So is it a cemetery? Is it a party room? Is it a solstice, right?
Well, that's interesting too, because was it erected because so many people have been buried there and therefore they thought it was significant in terms of a magical property? Or did people get buried there because Stonehenge was there? Like, which came first, right? The dead people or the rocks?
I'm pretty sure that the remains predate the rocks in some cases.
In some cases.
Yes.
So there is some theories about the healing, like Stonehenge being used as a place of healing. And there's good evidence to support this. It was believed that the blue stones, so those are the stones that feel a little different and look a little different, they come from the western part of Wales. So right on the coastline. And at this location, it was believed that these stones had magical healing properties, that the interaction between the water and the rocks could somehow heal you. And so that might have been the reason why these blue stones were transported across to Stonehenge. That would also support the belief of people coming from afar to seek healing from Stonehenge. And part of the evidence for this is the remains that we found around Stonehenge in very close vicinity of people that obviously grew up pretty far away. So the most famous one is the Amesbury Archer. Genetically, he would have grown up in the Swiss Alps, kind of in around Germany area.
Yeah.
So pretty far inland. Back then, a pretty major hike. And he was about 40-some years old when he died.
Okay.
And near him is another set of remains, also from the same geographical area, so also like Germanic Swiss, who died around 20. And the analysis on their remains found that they both had the same deformation in their bones. So this belief that it was a father and son that came to seek healing from Stonehenge.
Interesting.
Yeah. There are also other remains from the Scottish Highlands, from pretty far away, that were buried with weird deformities or some type of infection or ailment. And it's generally believed that these people traveled from afar either to die at Stonehenge or to be healed at Stonehenge.
Okay. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. So, I mean, this monument has meant a lot of different things to mm-hmm. a lot of different people over a lot of different years.
Yeah. It's tough because I think reading all of these theories, it's a lot of what articles are you reading, right? How well written are those articles? How much evidence do they support? And then it's up to you to believe what you want, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of those cases where, you know, your reservations about doing this episode on an engineering podcast were certainly valid, because so far, just about everything that we've talked about is just like, maybe, 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 right? But I think that when we get into how it was built, I'm gonna let you take care of that. One thing, just before we move on, in regards to the significance, there's this guy named Mike Parker Pearson, and there's also an archaeologist named Ramili Sanina. And so they've done research and they found that in these ancient times, timber was associated with the living and stone was associated with the dead. And so they've drawn evidence to support a theory that there was a funeral procession that went from nearby Woodhenge at sunrise and they marched to Stonehenge for sunset.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So kind of a funeral march. But again, is that why Stonehenge was built? Why wouldn't they just go from one Woodhenge to another Woodhenge, right? Like that's more how it was used after it was built.
Right, right.
But still kind of neat, I thought.
Yeah. Okay. Well, next we'll talk about what people think went into building these things.
All right. I look forward to it. All right. So in terms of how Stonehenge was built, we're definitely not doing an engineering podcast, because the truth of how Stonehenge was built is that Merlin hired... Don't laugh. This is real stuff.
Yeah. Vivian, who did Merlin hire? Stuff.
Merlin hired the Nephilim.
Wow.
Which are a race of giants. Basically, they went extinct during Noah's flood, which, as we know, was a time when the entire earth flooded.
Wasn't that after 3000 BCE though?
Yeah, so that's why Merlin had access to the Nephilim.
I see.
Yeah, so the Nephilim, they were still around. They're this race of giants, and Merlin transported the stones
okay.
to Stonehenge. And then he said, you giants, you build this thing up for me. But then the thing that bugs me is that the theory stops there. Like there's no... Why? It's just like, here's this thing and we don't know how it was built. Must be Merlin. Oh, but it's too tall for a wizard to do. Well, must be giants. And then it's just like, okay, so what was it used for? Just don't worry about it. Merlin did it. It was Merlin's reasons, right?
We're mixing so many lore. Okay. Well, that's one theory.
That's one theory. The other one, my personal favorite, put forth by my boy Eric von Daniken.
Okay.
Is that Stonehenge, much like other ancient monuments built around the time since and before, the technology and the spiritual significance was given to us by races of extraterrestrials.
Those right. are not Nephilims.
No, not Nephilims. Although okay. there are, interestingly enough, there is a lot of overlap between people that believe in Nephilim, Nephili, and people that believe in extraterrestrials.
You don't say.
Yeah. So I'm going to come clean with you right now. I have a copy of Eric von Daniken's best-selling book, Chariots of the Gods. The question mark is in the title of the book. I have tried so many times to read it and I just cannot get through it.
Is it too much science?
No, I accept on some level that there is a possibility that there are extraterrestrials.
Yeah, sure.
In the universe, I accept the possibility that maybe one or more of those races has mastered intergalactic travel.
Sure.
It's possible. It's all possible. But when someone is just like, oh, well, hey, the pyramids would have been really difficult for someone to build, had to have been aliens, right? It's...
Like, I don't know what aliens are flying around randomly building stone structures and then leaving. Like, this isn't Star Trek, you know? As much as I would like it to be.
Yeah.
It's not.
No, it just isn't. So I have some trouble with just that whole community, right?
Sure.
Like the ancient aliens. I just want to distance myself from ancient aliens right now.
Okay.
Okay. But those are the true facts of how Stonehenge was built.
I mean, I wouldn't call them facts, but I can't disprove them. So
yeah, exactly. Can't disprove them. You weren't there.
I can't say for sure how it was built. So, you know, I guess it's as legitimate as any of the things I'm about to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. So why don't you take it away with the real theories?
Okay. So, of course, the biggest question about Stonehenge is how are these stones transported? Blue stones are not native to the area. Like I said, the closest source is Western Wales. It's more than 200 kilometers away from Stonehenge. Lots of theories about how they got there. Perhaps they were transported by glaciers. I read a very strongly worded article where this guy was passionate about these stones being transported by glacier. But then I read a lot more about why that's not the case, because... John, if you remember, in Alberta, we do have a lot of rocks that's been transported by glacier.
Yep. In fact.
Yes. And what's the property of that?
That there's lots of little rocks that are pushed into the ground.
Yes. I mean, you're going to find glacial remains, but the most obvious thing is that in Alberta, you're going to see scattered all around random big rocks.
Yes.
Right? They're just everywhere.
Okay.
And in and around the Salisbury Plains, we don't find that. If glaciers did move through and drop these rocks around, we would have found a few of them.
Unless the glaciers were controlled by Merlin and Merlin trained the glaciers to pick up after themselves.
Uh-huh.
So he said, I only ordered 57 stones. Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, unless Merlin cleaned up, but no, generally the glacier theory doesn't hold up, right? Unless the glaciers moved exactly 57 stones and they used exactly 57 stones to build Stonehenge, which just doesn't seem likely.
It could have been a conscientious glacier.
Conscientious glacier.
No, I agree. Glaciers are the litter bugs of the natural world.
Yeah.
How's that for a comparison?
Okay. So that's the glacier theory, Exnade. There's some theories that it could have been transported by water for the most part, because of course, transporting things by water is going to be easier than transporting over land when you don't have wheels.
Right.
But they didn't really have boats either. So there's one theory that it was transported by raft along a natural water course, and it still had to be dragged some distance to where it ended up.
Right.
So they tried to test this. People love testing theories on Stonehenge. They love to recreate things. So they did this, I think in the 90s, and the raft sank.
Okay.
There's a theory that because they had discovered basket weaving, that they just wove a giant basket to put the stone into. and then drag it along from the banks to where it would land. And I mean, naturally it sank.
Yeah, because there's one thing about baskets is that they do not handle friction super well.
And they're not watertight?
No, like there's just...
like there's not enough buoyancy to keep up a rock? I don't know. I don't like... yeah. None of this makes sense. I feel like reading all these archaeological articles is just people who don't understand physics speculating how physics works.
Yeah. In a lot of the theories that we've read, we're kind of one step shy of maybe they just got lucky. Right?
Yeah. But I mean, they had to move a lot of these stones.
Yeah.
Right? So like if the basket fell apart or if the raft sank like every other time, it'd be a pretty big waste.
Yeah.
Okay. Remember that they didn't have a lot of material. They didn't have a lot of manpower.
Right.
There's some theory that it was just forcibly dragged along the ground. Right. This doesn't totally make sense. There's quite a bit of hills between Western Wales and Stonehenge. So it's hard enough to drag something over flat ground, but to have to drag it over mountains, it doesn't hold up. When you do the math of the amount of people you would need, it's in the hundreds. Now, I don't think back then they had that many people in one community.
Yeah. Plus, two, what are you going to do if you have hundreds of people dragging a big rock?
Right.
50.
Who's putting bacon on the table?
Exactly. Right? How do you feed those people?
Yeah.
So that one is not super great.
Not great. Okay. Some viable theories. There's an idea that stones were dragged with sleds. So kind of that they built these tracks out of wood and then a sled would be put into that track and you would tie the rock to the sled and then drag it along.
I like that.
Right? You would oil the track and oil the sled. And hopefully it would reduce the friction.
Okay. What's the matter with that one?
Still took too many men. Gotcha. It still just took way too many men, especially for the size of the rocks. And even oiling the tracks, it's still wood on wood. It's wood grain on wood grain.
Yeah, that's not going to go super well.
Yeah, it's just not enough to overcome the friction. Another viable option is wooden rollers. Okay, so then instead of having wheels, which they didn't have at the time, there's a theory that there were two kind of tracks that were laid out and wooden balls or stone balls that were all the same size within these tracks. And you would put this giant stone on top of these balls and then push them.
Okay, and then as... you'd take the one from the back and put it at the right. front. So that's a lot of work.
Right. But less work than the other theory, of course, is that you had wooden logs and then you were rolling it with logs.
Right.
Right.
So that's worse.
That's worse because logs are much heavier. It's harder to transport it from the back to the front, from back to the front. It's harder to make sure that they're all the same size. And it's hard to make sure that these wooden logs wouldn't split.
Okay.
Under the weight.
Interesting.
So the carved balls theory, I can't believe I'm calling it that.
Carved balls theory.
The carved balls theory seemed to have some teeth. Okay.
Okay.
So there were stone balls, carved stone balls that were found around Aberdeen, Scotland. In and around these giant ruins. Okay.
Okay.
And it's suggested that they use this method in Aberdeen to build their monuments, their Neolithic monuments. They're not as famous and as big as Stonehenge, but they're pretty significant and kind of around the same time.
Very cool.
So these stone balls, people have been trying to figure out what they were for. And so this is the one theory that they might have been used to transport the material. Now, we didn't find these stone balls around Stonehenge.
I see.
But we did find a chalk ball. And okay. The suggestion is that the people of Stonehenge had access to good quality wood. So they most likely would have carved balls out of hardwood rather than stone because it would have been much easier, right? They were still using stone tools.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It would have been easier to carve balls out of wood and make sure they were the same size and get them to be smooth. And of course, that wouldn't last that long.
Yeah, yeah, it would decompose pretty quickly.
And the one chalk ball is suggested that the Stonehenge people got their idea from the people from Aberdeen, made a prototype of the ball with chalk, and then brought it back and carved wooden balls thereafter based on this prototype.
I like that one.
It's a lot of if, right? Right. A lot of maybe they did this, maybe they did that. Anyway, that is the suggestion. Now, they did do an experiment of this. This theory was proposed in 2010 by a doctorate student. They tested it, and moving a 4-ton stone only required 6 or 7 people.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And the tracks themselves didn't leave any impressions in the ground. So it supports the fact that we don't see any evidence of it now.
Right.
But some experts do say that you wouldn't be able to replicate this with a 40-ton stone, which is what we do find at Stonehenge. Right. Right? Okay. The 4-ton stones are mostly the blue stones. Yeah. The sarsens are 40-ton.
Interesting.
They didn't end up testing it with the 40-ton stones. Some engineer that they interviewed said the wooden tracks would have split under that weight.
Yeah.
I mean, possibly a bit, but I feel like from an engineering perspective, that's something that they could have solved.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you think that it would split the track, then you would just kind of spread out the load a bit more so that it wouldn't be so pointed.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a viable option.
Okay. So the big wood balls theory.
Big wood balls theory.
Big wood balls theory holds water is what we're saying here.
Yeah. So that's kind of the most viable theory for how things were transported. Some other challenges that they would have faced. Excavation. Mm-hmm. So digging out the holes for the stones. There's some diagrams that shows online how they think that these stones were erected. And basically you dig a big hole, kind of a big trench, and then you pull the stone up from the other side with some type of rope or lever. Like I said, they didn't have rope. I really don't understand how some of these diagrams work. Like, it's very inconsistent between different accounts. So excavation, didn't have shovels, right? Okay. Didn't have iron, didn't have steel, didn't have bronze.
Yep.
What do you think they dug with?
I would guess that they dug with something better than their hands.
Uh-huh.
Did they make a stone shovel like in Minecraft?
No, they dug with antlers.
Antlers. Oh, that's brilliant.
So there's a lot of antler remains at the bottom of the ditches and the excavations. A lot of, broken antlers that you can find.
Nice. See, if they were really thinking, they would have just trained the bucks how to dig. It's like free labor and a good meal afterwards.
Well,
right?
I mean, I don't know why Merlin didn't do that.
Merlin had the Nephilim. Those guys dig with their hands. They're strong.
Some other interesting facts. The architecture of the Stonehenge and stones is actually something that you might not notice. The stones are finished slightly smoother on the inside.
Very cool.
Which you can't quite see now because you can't really go into the middle of Stonehenge. Yeah. But it is. It's smoother on the inside. Considering they didn't have sanding, they didn't have any of that. They just chiseled it out. Pretty impressive.
Very cool.
The upright stones are carved to be a little bit wider at the top so that from the ground it looks uniform all the way up. From
Brilliant.
Your perspective. That they had that kind of perspective and foresight at that time is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So the lintel stones, those are the stones that are on top of the ring.
Uh-huh.
They are not just a slab that's been put on top. Those lintel stones are carved with a slight curve to match the circular ring formation.
Really?
They're fitted together with tongue and groove joints. If you know anything about woodworking, tongue and groove joint is basically, if you're trying to fit two pieces of wood together, you would carve it so that it's like a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
Right? So that one would fit within the other and lock.
Yeah.
Those rocks are carved to actually fit together like puzzle pieces.
That is very impressive. I might be going back more towards the Eric von Daniken. We got some help from the aliens camp.
There's also grooves on the underside of the lintel and bumps on the top side of the upright so that it's almost like a Lego piece, like it fits on top and it doesn't shift laterally.
Yeah.
So on the bottom, it's fitted to the vertical columns, basically. And then from side to side, they're fitted with tongue and grooves.
Huh.
A lot of diagrams I saw about how they might have been erected was basically they built a giant ramp, right, up to the top of the upright stones, and then they would drag the lintel up and over.
Oh my goodness.
But this suggests that you would not just drag it up and over, but you would also have to make sure it's dragged perfectly into place and fitted with all the stones around it.
That's mental.
Like, it's difficult to do today with modern construction equipment.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking maybe some ETs drop down with a extra strong crane for them.
So that's kind of the architecture detail of Stonehenge.
Okay.
Next, I want to talk about the mathematics.
Oh my goodness, you sound so excited about this.
John was here when I went down this stupid rabbit hole of the geometry and mathematics of Stonehenge.
Yeah, it was good. She was thrilled about this. So she was complaining to me in bed as she was reading about it. And then I fell asleep. I didn't fall asleep mid-sentence. I'm not that mean, but I did fall asleep before she was done studying. And then she regaled me with all of the miserable details the following morning. It's dumb. So buckle up, okay? Get ready for this.
Okay, so there's, like I said, a lot of theories about what the geometry of Stonehenge means, how it was built. So there are a series of holes that surround Stonehenge. The Aubrey Stones is 56 stones that are laid out in a perfect circle, equidistant to each other.
Okay.
There are the Y and Z holes, which are almost perfect circles, but more like a spiral. Like the end, there's two where the ends don't meet.
Right.
Okay. So then there's the question of why are they spirals, right? Yeah. Why did they build two spirals?
Oh my.
How did they build two spirals? Because a spiral is a circle with constant changing radius. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If you were drawing a circle, you would just put a stake in the middle, take a rope, and then walk around it, right? It's your constant radius. That's a perfect circle. That's easy to draw.
Sure, because every rotation
is the same radius. Right. You're as far from the pole, no matter which direction you're going.
Yeah.
A spiral means that you put a stake in the ground and you're constantly shortening or lengthening your radius as you walk around it so that you have a constant changing radius that eventually turns into a spiral.
Yes. Okay.
So how did they do this? Why did they do this? The Y and Z holes, their spirals, they also fit with each other. They're not coincidences. So one set, the outer set of spirals, if you draw the biggest square within that circle as you can, the other set of spirals fits perfectly inside that square.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
You following?
I think I see what you're saying.
So drawing two perfect spirals that perfectly fit into each other, how did they do that?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of articles citing the same paper, and I've not found this paper because it's not a paper. It's a book. I'm not buying or reading an entire book by an archaeologist. Like, I firmly believe that you have a scientific discovery, you publish it in a peer-reviewed paper.
Sure.
This was not. This is published, a self-published book, okay?
Self-published.
This guy, not just a guy, but like, I mean, an archaeologist, he published a book that says through computer-assisted design software, he was able to prove that the people of Stonehenge knew about Pythagoras' theorem before Pythagoras, which I buy. That's fine. There are lots of ancient civilizations that figured out right angle triangles before Pythagoras.
Sure.
Basically, he was saying that he used CAD, computer-assisted design, to prove that they were able to draw these spirals. Now, I use CAD, right? It's not a special tool in engineering. CAD is basically like MS Paint with more functionality.
Yeah, it's got like a ruler built in, right?
Yeah, it's a drafting tool.
Yeah.
It doesn't prove anything. It, like, I don't understand. It's like saying, well, with this calculator, I can prove that they drew this. Like, it makes no logical sense. And yet, every single article that I've seen citing this stupid book uses exactly those language.
That sucks.
As a layperson, you might not know what that means, but it means nothing.
Yeah.
It means nothing.
Sure.
Okay. And then I found another article about the mathematics of Stonehenge. And within the paper, the author writes that he did not agree with this book. This was a published paper.
Okay.
Okay, so I read through it, and this was the one that kept me up all night, because I swear I read this thing over, like, over and over and over again within 36 hours.
Yeah.
What this guy said about these spirals was, first, you draw a little triangle with a right angle.
Yeah.
And you flip it to get an isosceles triangle.
Okay, so two right triangles put together
gives you an isosceles triangle. That's a triangle with two equal sides. Okay. Yeah. That's fine. I follow. And then he explains what Pythagoras to you, like you're a dummy.
Right.
Okay.
Which I'm definitely not.
If you do not remember what Pythagoras is that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Okay.
Where I knew that.
Two sides of your right angle triangle, if you know the lengths of them, you can figure out the length of your hypotenuse, which is the long side. Okay. So he explains this and you're like, yeah, I follow. He gets you to draw all these triangles. And then he says, and then using linear regression, we draw the circle.
Okay.
Which means nothing. This means nothing. Linear regression is what you do when you have a bunch of data and you're trying to represent the trend of the data with a line.
Right.
Drawing a bunch of tiny triangles inside Stonehenge, like not touching the edges of Stonehenge, just inside Stonehenge, and then saying that you're using linear regression to draw a circle makes no sense. Okay. I kept reading this heavy math article, and then I finally drilled it down to that paragraph, and I realized this is nothing.
It's nothing.
This is nothing. It's a bunch of archaeologists writing math papers that mean nothing. If anyone out there understands this, please feel free to correct me. It is beyond me, okay? I don't want to brag, but I'm pretty freaking good at math.
Yes, so that is a challenge. Can you explain this to Vivian, or is she correct in saying that it's wrong?
Yeah, there are parts that I really take issue with. That right. makes no sense.
Yeah.
However, that being said, those 56 stones, those Aubrey stones, there is a viable theory for what they're for.
Okay.
So if you think about what a circle is.
Okay, I'm doing it now.
You could approximate a circle with a bunch of triangles. All right? So bear with me here.
Yeah, bearing.
If you were to draw a square within the circle, there's obviously areas that you're not covering with that square, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That square is basically made out of four triangles with points in the middle.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Gotcha. Yeah, gotcha.
Okay. If you were to draw a pentagon inside a circle, that's a little bit more accurate than the square inside the circle, right?
Yeah.
And that's five triangles. with the points in the middle.
Okay.
So you can keep doing this where you draw smaller and smaller triangles, but more and more of them. And you would get a better representation of a circle.
Yeah. Okay. And so would I be correct if I were to say that a circle has unlimited points around the outside?
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. So very basic foundational theories that lead into calculus is that from this theory of, you know, getting more and more accurate to the circle by using more and more triangles, a circle could essentially be an infinite amount of triangles with infinitesimally small degree.
Okay.
So the Aubrey stones is 56 perfect circle of equidistant stones, right?
Okay.
So that's a 56-sided polygon inside a circle.
Ah.
A fairly good representation of a circle.
Yeah.
So that's like 56 little triangles, right?
Sure.
It's much easier to calculate the area of a triangle than it is to calculate the area of a circle, especially when back then you didn't know what pi was.
Right.
By having 56 poles around the circle, you can say that one side is the length of a pole.
Okay.
And you know the length to the center of the circle because you measured it out, right? It's a constant radius.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think it's 7.
Okay.
Okay. So you can figure out what the area of this 56-sided polygon is by taking the area of 56 of these triangles that you can easily calculate, because you can calculate an area of a triangle.
Yeah.
And 56 just means you multiply it by 56.
Perfect.
And you've approximated the area of the circle.
Hmm.
By approximating the area of the circle, knowing also what the outside circumference is, because you've got 56, so the circumference is just 56, right?
Yeah.
You know also the diameter or the radius. You can approximate the value of pi, okay?
Yeah, okay.
So if you do the math, which I can post up my equations, it's much easier to just see visually than me explain it.
Yeah.
The people of Stonehenge, if they actually used this for this purpose, would have approximated pi at 3.11.
It's close enough.
It is incredibly close compared to the Babylonians and the Chinese, who at the time used just 3.
Wow. Okay, hey, there you go.
So was this used to approximate pi? I don't know, but it could have been a way for them to actually capture this knowledge in an oral tradition.
Right. I like it. That's a feel-good story right there.
Okay. That was very math heavy. Did that make sense?
It was good. I feel like it made sense.
Okay. Good.
I might be understanding it completely wrong, but that's for me to know and you to find out.
I'll draw some diagrams that I can post up.
Okay.
And if you have any questions...
Yeah, hit us up on social media.
Yeah, please reach out. All right. Just some final stats. It's estimated that the manpower needed to build Stonehenge would have probably been around 11,000 man hours or 460 man days of work. And that was just for the first phase of Stonehenge. Stonehenge phase two would have taken about 15,000 man days or 41 years, basically.
Oof.
And then Stonehenge 3, which is the last phase, and that includes the movement of the blue stones, would have taken 1.75 million hours or 200 years of work. If one guy
intense.
Took 200 years.
I don't think he would make it.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, in 2003, Wally Wallington, what a name, Wally Wallington, a retired construction worker from Michigan, built a Stonehenge replica in his yard using low-tech methods. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
He did this thing. I wish I could find like a video or something of this. He moved large objects by placing walnut-sized rocks underneath them and spinning them. So very close to our carved balls theory, but like rather than moving them along a track, he spun them. Not entirely sure how this works.
I like it. I can kind of envision it.
He has single-handedly, by himself, moved an entire barn using this method.
I like it. I like this guy.
Wally Wallington.
Good for you.
Yeah. I always feel like these episodes need at least one hero.
Yeah.
And why not? Why not Wally?
Yeah. I was going to give the hero to Merlin this time, but Wally Wallington. If you're listening to this, you're the hero of this episode.
That's right. And that's all I have on Stonehenge. I don't know if you have any more notes.
I just have one little factoid. There's a widespread belief. I'm going to call it a widespread belief that Stonehenge, you know, was constructed in cooperation from a number of different tribes that were in the area at the time.
Okay.
And so a lot of people have sort of begun to treat it as like a symbol of unification, right? Kind of like a peace, right? So anyhow, of course, during the 70s, people clung on to this interpretation and they had what was called Stonehenge Free Festival. This is a festival that ran for 10 years, 1974 to 1984, and it was sort of a lead-in to the solstice every year. People would go. And I don't want to generalize, but basically, this festival attracted a lot of hippies.
And DJs.
And it wouldn't have been so much DJs at the time, but there was a lot of open air drug trading. Like people weren't subtle about it or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So the British government or the Heritage Society, I can't remember who, cracked down and they said, during the solstice, nobody's getting within 4 miles of this thing. And they fenced off Stonehenge, which I'm still angry about. Right? Because I'm not going to touch anything. I'm not going to take anything. I just want to go stand in the middle of it. You know, like we were way far back when we went to see Stonehenge. I would have liked to have gotten closer. Anyhow, I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed. Now, there is a man named Arthur Uther Pendragon.
Oh, baby. Yeah. Okay.
This is another guy. I started reading about him and I kind of, I didn't get too far. But
before you get down this road, I asked John to look into this guy because while I was looking up what these math articles were about, I was Googling Stonehenge geometry, Stonehenge mathematics, and Stonehenge geometry dropped me down a rabbit hole of Stonehenge sacred geometry.
Yes.
In which this guy gives a lecture about how if you take this number and multiply it by 10, it is the same number as, I don't know, the number of Jesus' disciples or something. It made no sense.
Yeah.
It had no significance. And I had no idea what I was watching.
Yeah. So a little bit of background on Arthur Uther Pendragon. He is a modern day Druid.
What even is that?
I think that that much is very valid. He's a colorful character and, you know, he has a great Wikipedia page.
He believes he is the reincarnation of King Arthur.
Yeah, we're not here to attack Arthur Uther Pendragon. So he maintains that Stonehenge is still a site of significant religious significance. Significant religious significance. Just double down on it. Right. And they removed some of the remains that they found to take them to a university and study them in more detail. He's been campaigning to have them, you know, put those back because you shouldn't disturb the dead. He fought and apparently he lost his specific case, but it was later turned over due to a different decision after he went to court about it to remove the 4 mile no-go zone during the solstices because Stonehenge is spiritually significant. So, I mean, he's upholding in a lot of ways, Stonehenge has more than just a tourist attraction, which regardless of what I think of his claims, I think that it is pretty cool to protect it because Stonehenge is very touristified.
I mean, Stonehenge is protected. It's a UNESCO protected site and recognized site.
Yeah, but I mean, what good is protecting something doing if you're taking it away from the people it's important to?
Fair enough. Religious significance of a site is really whatever you ascribe to it. So, I mean, all the power to him.
Pretty neat.
Okay, so this was a very history heavy episode.
Yeah.
We did touch on some of the engineering and construction significance of the site.
There was a little bit of math. Yeah, this one is just, if you're listening to this and you're being like, this is not an engineering podcast, that's my fault. Because I love Stonehenge so much. I think that it's so cool. When I was a kid growing up, I always just thought that it was so cool. I wanted to go there. I wanted to see it. And then I finally got to see it shortly after my 30th birthday. And it was so cool. That's just it. It's just, you look at it and it's cool. I love it.
So I think in the previous episodes, I've always asked John if you would be interested in visiting any of these sites or monuments. And I don't think you've shown nearly as much enthusiasm for any of them as you have for Stonehenge.
It's because the other ones, we know that they definitely were not built by aliens. I like the mystery. I like being able to look at something and say, I wonder how that was built. Maybe that was built like that, but maybe not. Maybe it was something completely out to lunch that I haven't even considered. I love it. I love it so much.
You know, at the beginning of the episode, we said that we'll tell you about how it was built and why and by who. And I'm not sure that we've really answered much of those questions, but it's definitely made the two of us think about Stonehenge. And I agree. I think I would go back now with different eyes.
Yeah.
If you guys loved this episode or hated it, if you wanted more engineering, if you wanted less math, let us know what you think. Subscribe and rate on whatever podcast platform you're using. We'd really appreciate it. Reach out to us on all our social media. We're on Facebook at Measured in Metric. We're also on Instagram at Measured in Metric, on Twitter at Measured in Met, or you can visit our website, measuredinmetric.com. Special thanks to Astronomic Audio for editing and sound engineering and taking out all our bloopers. And remember to always measure in metric.